pounds down and counting from the cover of a magazine in the checkout line at Walgreens. But then I buy the magazine, only to find out the big secret was SlimFast or bypass surgery, and that is totally fine, for real. But whoever got full off a shake? And United Healthcare is like, yeah, right, tubby. So I guess I'm stuck throwing these deck chairs off the Titanic one at a goddamn time. Right now, I'm sporadically trying to be vegan because I love animals and being a good steward of the environment. LOL, JK, I have inflammatory bowel disease, and nothing is more inflammatory than meat and milk. But wow, oh wow, I've never tried anything so difficult in my life, and I was homeless before. Eating with any sort of intention is terrible, especially when you, one, work hard all week, and two, have trouble with plebeian tasks like grocery shopping and basic caring for yourself. Mavis is a health person, but she lives 2+ hours away. And that's good for, say, not wanting her to know how much Family Feud I actually cry tears of joy while watching. But bad for wanting to holler, let me get one of them wheatgrass spirulina drinks you're making, from the comfort of my bed while burning one calorie distractedly scratching at a patch of dandruff. Fail to plan, plan to fail. I know, I know. And I'm the queen of excuses, so let's just run through a few of them so I can prove to those of you who doubt me that there's really no possible way for me to be good at this. One, I get up too early in the morning. My alarm goes off at 5:50 a.m. First thing I do is check to make sure I'm not dead. If I am, in fact, still alive, I usually sob uncontrollably until there's nothing left in my tear ducts but salt dust. Then grope blindly through my apartment to the bathroom, where I say a little prayer for a hole to open beneath my building and swallow us all. I can hardly muster the strength to take a bird bath and pull on my yoga pants that have never seen the inside of a gym, let alone cook steel-cut oats and make a kale smoothie. Two, I work with people who eat their feelings, too. This sisterhood understands that the solution to a dreary morning slash a shitty interaction with a petulant dog mom slash gloopy, crampy menstruation slash a disappointing season finale you stayed up late to watch is a delicious, overpriced lunch delivered by a young bicycle messenger with a hot beard and muscular calves. I never want to spend $15 on a meal I will eat on the toilet because there's no place else to get some peace and quiet. But I always do, because I am a stunted adolescent who was never taught constructive ways to deal with her emotions. I wish, more than a person has ever wished for anything, that a piece of rye Melba toast with a smear of almond butter provided the temporary happiness found at the bottom of a carton of Massaman curry, but alas, it simply does not. Three, my joints still hurt. After much half-hearted consumption of every legume, sprouted grain, cheese made from nuts, and root vegetables snatched from the loving clutches of the earth, I know that the degenerative disease currently snacking on my sacroiliac joint will maybe hold off for an hour so I could stand in front of the stage and get sweated on by Drake, but I'm so sad, and this is America, so I want my bones to stop hurting while I eat cheese. I have an $800 tiny robot computer that can tell me the weather in Tokyo and knows to suggest ho when I finish typing the phrase, yeah, right. But science can't figure out a way for me to have a little yogurt without my having to rely on a walker the next day. Four, staying committed to things is hard. I have 7 different body washes lining the edge of my bathtub right now. 5, the list of trash foods you can apparently still eat while trying to be vegan. Spicy sweet chili Doritos, Nutter Butters, Swedish Fish, Fritos, Goya Flan, unfrosted Pop-Tarts, Snyder's of Hanover jalapeno pretzels, Pringles, Oreos. I'm not sure if these are all really real, But that kind of seems beside the point, considering that I'm attempting to whittle a third grader off my backside. If I have to try to wipe the memory of the sharp, sweet sting of Italian salami from the taste buds in my mind, then I'm not going to ruin whatever progress I make by shoveling fistfuls of Pop-Tarts in my mouth every day. This is what I'm like. I don't ever buy juice because I've got so many fitness articles and printouts from the nutritionist burned into my brain about empty calories and mindless sugar consumption that I don't even go near it. My eyes don't even wander over to the juice section. And that sounds so good and so health conscious, but the real gag is that I don't want to waste 1,000 calories on apple juice, a cheap and unsatisfying provisional solution to my despair, when I could invest those same calories in something that will really dull the sharp edge of life's blade, like a slice of the birthday cake that was half price because little Timmy's parents never picked it up. So yeah, there's never going to be a 12-pack of beer in my fridge, empty calories, but you might find a chocolate gift basket I sent to myself and signed someone else's name for. Empty calories that stave off sadness for approximately 20 minutes. I don't know that I'm always happy in this big body, or what there is that I can actually do about it. I was not born to delicate people. My mom was 6 feet tall, and my dad was short and broad with oversized hands that he gifted me along with my life. This rotting meat corpse they created is riddled with inexplicable disease and is as wide as it is tall. I was never destined to be a waif or to have a less than terrible relationship with food. I grew up poor, anxious, and unhappy, with cheap carbohydrates the only affordable substitute for joy. If I had a depressed kid right now, I'd drag him to a doctor and ask for some Wellbutrin, but that was never an option for tiny me. Even as a kid, when I did all the fantasizing that little kids do, I never pictured a tall, strapping man hoisting me into his tuxedo-clad arms, the itchy netting of my veil rustling against his beard as we descend the steps of a church of his choosing, as a crowd of our loved ones throws confetti over our heads. I had an incredibly realistic imagination, and I knew that no husband of mine would ever be picking me up. After exchanging legal vows and a chaste kiss in front of the judge, my future husband and I would walk with grim determination from the courthouse, hand in hand and Velcroed into our most sensible shoes, get into our roomy mid-sized sedan, then eat the Tuesday afternoon lunch special at IHOP. We'd toast with overcooked sausage links because IHOP doesn't serve booze, then drive to our unpretentious ranch-style house to make love one time and never again until we died. So I bought a bunch of vegan cookbooks. I soaked the overnight oats. I made the fake cheese out of cashews and an onion and a carrot and a potato. I resisted the temptation of milk chocolate, even though dark chocolate tastes like ants. And it felt fine. I felt fine. I made this amazing chickpea masala in my own kitchen that tasted almost as good as takeout. Pretty sure the first time I faltered was at the movie theater. I love, love, love going to the movies. And when I do, I like to have popcorn. And a fountain Coke, because I live for the burning snap of a freshly carbonated beverage. I went to see The Hateful Eight alone on a Saturday afternoon after work. I bought my ticket and willed myself to go straight to the theater, to not even glance at the concession stand, but I could not resist the siren call of the self-serve soda machine. I changed my inner mantra from, "You don't need anything," to, "Fine, just get a drink." But as soon as I rounded the corner and heard the Colonels popping their glorious staccato, I jumped into the popcorn line and promised to make Cuban black beans and rice for the next 3 days. I was able to control myself enough to get both a small popcorn and a root beer. Curveball, this girl's full of surprises. But the minute the first buttered bite hit my tongue, I was like, "Lord, I have made a dire mistake." the vegan thing, not the popcorn, just so we're clear. The next day, as I was chopping tomatoes and red peppers for a gazpacho, I decided that although I would continue to try my best to steer clear of meat and cheese, going forward, I would never again publicly refer to myself as vegan. Then, if I decided to eat some carnitas or have an eggnog at Christmas, no one I know from the internet could look down his judgmental nose at my choices. Carnivore in the streets, person who has eaten a carrot masquerading as a hot dog in the sheets. Million Dollar Mermaid. A solid 75% of the time I am awake, I am in pain akin to that of childbirth. Sometimes you can read the excruciating discomfort on my face, but I've gotten really good at masking it so that it just looks like I'm stifling an unpleasant bit of gas. People are always asking me what Crohn's feels like, and my answer is this. It's like a compact car is trying to drive through my small intestines all the time. Seriously, and it doesn't matter if I eat or don't eat or whatever. Oh, here's something fun. I don't care what diet you're on or what herbal supplements you take. If they work for you, I'm happy. I don't know if it's something about me or if people walk around just dispensing unfounded medical advice to everyone they've ever met with a health issue, but more often than I'm comfortable with, some asshole with a high school diploma wants to sit me down and talk at me about how they can cure my wretched gut disease. There's always some bag of dicks with a beer in his hand, a triple cheeseburger on his plate, and a cigarette in his mouth trying to talk to me about healthy eating. And with zero trace of irony. I appreciate the effort, I really do, but this shit is autoimmune and I have a gastroenterologist. If all I had to do was put down this taco and take those herbs your grandma swears by, I'd already be cured. Thanks, though. This arthritis and I decided that feeling like garbage all the time is for the birds and that we were going to have to do something about it. And that something probably needed to be swimming. Except, aside from the fact that I seriously do not possess the kind of body I am comfortable displaying in a bathing suit, and how I adore and admire those girls who do, scrolling through their gorgeous round tummies and dimpled bottoms, proudly sticking out of their fat teenies on Tumblr. But I'm not there yet, and I really am not trying to get my bikini area waxed, or shave my armpits, or risk being in a pool full of sexy, young, hairless aliens looking like my real self. In my imagination, the local YMCA is a shining beacon full of healthy, tan, chlorine-scented muscles gleaming beneath the fluorescent lights overhead, a happy place full of health-conscious singles mingling over protein shakes and energy bars, goggles and towels draped gently around their necks, as they flirt and laugh about the number of calories they've burned on that complicated-looking stair machine. And those mental images are precisely why I decided to take senior aqua aerobics. I need to be around some pancake arms and spider veins and National Geographic titties for real. But first, a bathing suit. Typically, I'd wear a thong and a couple of small halved coconuts for this sort of endeavor, but I thought it would serve me best to be modest, for the first class at least. After I'd barricaded myself in a corner at Lane Bryant, shivering and cowering like a child in a horror movie, handfuls of jewel-toned polyester clutched to my chest, a saleswoman approached me and hesitantly asked if I required some assistance. "I'd like to see your most opaque turtleneckini," I declared, "and your finest ankle-length swim bloomers." Her eyes widened with concern as she tried to determine whether I was insane. "Were you guys aware that those things don't exist?" I was shocked, too. Anyway, a friend told me I should get a two-piece in case I needed to go to the bathroom and didn't want to do so while completely naked. Why didn't I think of something as practical as that? So I pointed to the wall of mix-and-matchables and snatched a black tank top with a built-in, full-coverage underwire bra and some sort of panty, skort, culotte type of contraption for my bottom half. Literally the closest I could come to being fully clothed, yet appropriately dressed for water calisthenics. I got up early on the following Monday and put on my bathing suit under my clothes, because while I don't care about your grandma comparing my stretch marks to hers, I didn't want to make my introductions while trying to secure my breasts in those stupid cups. Helen Keller was rolling her eyes, muttering, "Not even going to trim the sides, eh?" under her fishy breath, while I was figuring out how to step into that silly bottom piece. I threw a shoe at her head, just barely missing her horns. After I paid, it costs $8 to participate in the aerobics, I staked out the quietest row of the locker room where I could sit and listen in relative peace to Shirley and Elaine squawking about Medicare and using double coupons to shop at Kohl's until it was time to get into the heated baby pool. I was immediately transported back to my days as the poor kid at summer camp, whose mom sent along the previous night's meatloaf and an off-brand thermos full of milk for lunch instead of peanut butter and jelly with a high C like everyone else. Every day I would plead with her, "No one else brings tuna helper or liver and onions. Please stop ruining my young life." I was that kid with the stinky home lunch that had to be heated up, while everyone else brought delicious, shelf-stable potato chips and pudding cups. No wonder I got pushed to the ground so often. Quit playing like you don't know what I mean. Everybody knows that one kid who brought the metal fork from home. And that poor, sad bastard was me. Anyway, all of these milkshakes had brightly colored beach towels with them, and I flushed with shame as I pulled my house towel out of my bag. Stop laughing. I have pretty decent towels, but they are plain white and boring beige and don't wrap all the way around my body. These ladies brought towels in swirling purples and pinks and blues and greens, made specifically for fun times at the local pool. They obviously have mothers who actually love them. I took a cue from the other ladies and wore my cover-up out of the locker room. What is that thing called? A beach robe? Pool jammas? Grabbed my goggles and tube and hand buoys, then tried not to slip and crack my skull open on the deck. One glance at my feet and I thought, a pedicure should have happened yesterday, then slipped into the pool before anyone noticed my bruised-looking toes. When I was a baby, poor people sent their kids to the YWCA for daycare, and as a result, I learned to swim before I could even speak full sentences. They for real just throw you in the swimming pool the minute you get there, pull you out twice a day to poop and eat a couple of graham crackers, then toss you right back in. You go home on the bus and sleep straight through dinner until breakfast the next morning. It's a dream. Being in the water doesn't scare me, but explaining my horrifying scarlet birthmark to strangers does, so I avoided the crowd in the center of the pool and hung back near the ladder. As we were doing K-treads to the lively medley of Patti LaBelle's greatest up-tempo hits, a lady waddled in, and I caught some weird looks being exchanged among the other women. She had a house towel, too, so I just assumed these elitist snobs were giving her a hard time for it. I made a mental note to later ask someone in better shape than I am where to procure appropriate beach accessories. The new lady didn't say anything, just slid on her floaties and asked one of the too-hot-to-be-working-this-shift lifeguards to help lower her into the pool next to where I was sweating with the other oldies. One of the bitter Bettys in front of me, I think they were all named Martha or Lucille or Janice, turned to sneer before rejoining the group in their uniform leg-kicking. I couldn't stop looking back and forth between them. It was the real-life sequel to Mean Girls. During the otter roll, please kill me, there was more vicious whispering aimed in our general direction, which I almost didn't notice because I was having a bitch of a time struggling to keep my breasts secured inside my top. All of that gentle, low-impact movement was doing a really efficient job of gently removing my tits from where I'd strapped them down and shoving one back in once it has escaped is the worst. That class was hard as hell. Next time you're at the pool, no more snickering behind your hands when you see lumps of curdled cottage cheese, bicep curling water weights, and bunny kicking in the shallow end. I have a newfound respect for active seniors. After that brutality, all I wanted was to go to the daycare room and find my sleeping cot and take a nap. In the locker room after class, a bottle of amlodipine I dropped rolled over to where the outcast was changing back into her pleated pants. She picked it up, and when she returned it to me, I couldn't help but ask why the other women hated her so much. Turns out they all live in the same assisted living facility. An outcast had recently taken up with one of the few eligible bachelors who could still eat solid foods and drive a car at dusk. The other women didn't like her, and they liked her even less when they found out that old Levitra was sticking his mothballs in her. I sat on the bench wrapped in my house towel, mouth agape, through the entire story. When she finished, I was like, "You are the coolest," and started pulling my hoodie on over my bathing suit. Outcast smiled at the compliment and told me she looked forward to getting splashed in the face by my uncoordinated arm movements next time. "And you're going to get a yeast infection if you wear that bathing suit home. You young girls think you know everything." I never went back. Whole wheat ricotta crepes. So I tried Nutrisystem. I'm not even sure where I got the idea, but I went online, gave them all my money, checked off a bunch of delicious-sounding food items, and waited for them to be delivered to my job, because that's where I am between the hours of 7:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. every day. As soon as the first boxes arrived, I knew I'd made a huge mistake. I try not to be a conspicuous person, because I don't like talking to people about anything I'm doing, but especially not about something as ridiculous as needing to pay hundreds of dollars for portion-controlled meals. I know there are people who can spend hours talking about diets, and maybe if I were one of them, I could actually find one that sticks, but I'm too easily embarrassed to get into the minutiae of what I eat, and when, and how often, to ever have a conversation about it. That's why I won't go into debt trying to see a therapist. I'm so humiliated all the time that it forces me to be dishonest. And what is the point of therapy if you can't come clean about what your problems are without wanting to pull a hat down over your eyes or jab yourself with a pair of scissors? I burned with shame as I filled the communal freezer with a month's worth of tiny meatloaf sandwiches and single-serving desserts, hoping no one would catch me and demand a detailed explanation of my path toward health and wellness. Online, the white cheddar mac and cheese had looked plump and inviting, the tortilla soup spicy and delicious. In real life, the tiny cans and dehydrated cups looked like something you'd make for a baby. They were kind of delicious, though, but in a hot lunch program kind of way. Like, if you are the kind of person who would never lower yourself to eat a McNugget, you are most certainly not going to be able to handle Nutrisystem. That vacuum-sealed goodness is not for people who insist on doing shit like soaking their own beans and making bread from scratch. Thank God I grew up living that peel-and-eat life. The drawback was that everything I ate made me have the kind of farts that make you check your underpants for burn holes afterward. The kind of farts that sear your asshole as they exit. The kind of farts that have teeth. Even with the IBD, I've managed to jury-rig a pretty predictable poop schedule, but those coconut almond bars and arroz con pollo and bean bolognese had me cutting people off mid-sentence to run to the bathroom. I would have to meticulously plan what trains to take to avoid being stuck on one with a meal replacement bar racing through my lower intestine at max speed. I would fart without even realizing it was happening. I couldn't walk down the street to get a coffee without people crossing to the other side to avoid the gassy cloud following me around. And when I wasn't burning calories from breaking a continuous stream of putrid wind, I was sweating on the toilet as 3 ounces of food karate chopped its way through my intestinal tract. After 2 months, I went to see Dr. Jackson for a skin problem, and she was like, "Your face looks so slim. Want to hop on the scale just for fun?" First of all, no. The words scale and fun do not go together in my mind, especially since she insists on using the old-timey triple beam scale where you have to stand, trembling, for the 229 interminable seconds it takes for her to slide the rider back and forth, a little to the left, no, back to the right, wait a little bit more left, oh no, way over to the right, while you pretend you can actually hold your thighs together for as long as it takes for her to come up with still too fat. But that day I'd lost some weight, and she clapped her hands excitedly while I wondered if maybe my right foot hadn't been all the way on. She asked what I'd been doing, and I told her I was trying Nutrisystem. But truth be told, I didn't know whether I'd actually lost weight or if the colonic effect of those protein shakes had just flushed out the 7 pounds of undigested food hanging out in my colon. My stomach churned and gurgled. Then she listened to it with a stethoscope, her eyebrows raised in alarm. "You might not be the best candidate for a program like this," she sighed, pointing at my midsection. "It sounds like a soccer match is going on in there." "But I still have 3 weeks' worth of meals," I protested, delicately fingering my newly svelte jawline. "Fine, eat them." Dr. Jackson tucked her notes in her armpit and shook my hand, as she does after every session, and started for the door. "I'll email the pharmacy your prescriptions, and maybe you should buy some diapers." Cow pose. I recently started yoga, and by started, I mean I've gone to 2 classes in the last few weeks. Between my real job and my freelance jobs and the hours I've set aside to watch television, I don't have any time. So finding activities that fit into the narrow window I have not dedicated to making money for someone else is rare. I hated the physical therapy I was doing for my broken foot that never healed, so my podiatrist suggested yoga. Gross, right? The only class I could find that's 1, cheap, 2, near the train, 3, at a time I could actually make, and 4, not taught by a person I know in real life, was for pregnant women. And I signed right up. The flyer at Metropolis Coffee Shop advertised the class as incredibly easy, laid back, no pressure. I guzzled my scalding coffee. I hadn't put enough sugar in because a handsome stranger had been standing next to me and I didn't want him to know I'm a child, and studied the faded pink sheet of paper. I figured it would be my kind of party because the word easy was underlined 5 times with a thick black Sharpie. Who the fuck wrote that? I mean, nothing says easy more than a pregnant lady could do this, I guess. If I saw a pregnant woman skydiving or bungee jumping or performing open heart surgery, I would think smugly, "Hey, I could probably do that." I didn't hesitate or think twice until I walked into the room in my comfiest outside pajamas and found myself surrounded on all sides by gestating bellies and nervous pre-class chatter about back pain and morning sickness. Oh, right. These women are actually pregnant. I was so busy thinking about how no one would ask me to touch my toes that I kind of ignored the whole carrying another human being aspect of this physical and spiritual practice. In general, I've got enough stomach jibs to pass for early second trimester if anyone decided to really get up close and inspect me, but I decided to keep a low profile and chill in the back, not saying a word. If there's any place where staying mute with your eyes on the floor is appropriate, a yoga studio has got to be it. I loved that first class. It was air-conditioned, and the yogini used the word gentle about 80 times, which is music to my joints. My foot felt good, My self-esteem wasn't shattered into a million pieces, and everyone appeared to be having as hard a time as I was getting up off the floor. I went back a couple of times, but nobody likes an outsider. Seriously, skinny people want your fat ass out of their clothing stores. Straight people want your gay ass out of their bars. And white people want your black ass out of their presidency. So my empty womb and I were scared to admit that we weren't packing no embryo. I really liked the teacher, and I hope Diana's baby isn't Breech, and I would love to know what names Maureen decides on for the twins, but I don't want to look like a weirdo with a pregnancy fetish or some other Dateline type shit. Nor do I want to be the douchebag who couldn't cut it in regular yoga. Because, yeah, I couldn't. And let's not even talk about that 200-degree sauna yoga. Are you kidding me? But I'm not savvy enough to keep a good lie going. I can't keep rolling into class and not talking. Or growing. Plus, I don't trust myself. One of these days I'm going to forget where I am and ask one of these girls for an emergency tampon, and the whole lot of them will realize what I've done and line up to beat the crap out of me. Living is a mistake. Mavis wanted to host a brunch for me to meet all of her close mom friends. I wasn't nervous about it because I'm charming and do well with moms. I couldn't decide what to wear because I'm at a time in my life when nothing I put on feels good and even fewer things look good. And the t-shirt and jeans I would like to spend my days wearing aren't always appropriate, nor is the hoodie. And if we're being honest, the jeans don't always fit right. Jeans and bras, man, are they ever 100% cool? So while homegirl was downstairs baking the quiche and cutting fruit into appetizing shapes, I was trying on and taking off the three hideous shirts I leave in the half a drawer designated as mine. I knew before I even got my clothes on that the day was going to be a toilet. Sometimes you just know. It's hard not to feel like an animal on display when someone throws a party for people to meet you. Even though I am always 100% flattered when someone wants me to stammer awkwardly through an introduction and try to come up with a sincere response to, "I've heard a lot about you," that isn't, "Oh my God, am I not satisfying her sexually?" Women started to arrive, wearing their nicest smiles and loaded down with church donuts and breakfast casseroles, and I felt better than I'd expected. My clammy nerves had settled down. I was picking at my breakfast in a convincing way. I hate eating in front of strangers. And I had just begun to relax when I felt a weird hitch in my wobbly chair. 3 seconds later, I went crashing to the fucking ground, taking a platter of French toast bites with me. The five stages of, holy shit, I just broke a chair in front of people. 1, denial. I'm not on the floor. You're on the floor. 2, anger. This is what happens when you buy chairs at a resale shop, bitch. 3, bargaining. Please, God, if you kill everyone in this dining room right now, I promise I will try to recycle all of the Slim Fast cans I swear I'm going to start buying. 4, depression. I am fat enough to kill chairs. I don't deserve oxygen. 5, acceptance. Well, since I'm already fat, fuck these toast points. Let's get a pizza. Turns out Mavis hadn't put the chair together correctly, but tell that to the bruises spreading like wildfire across my tender ego. I spent the rest of the brunch standing awkwardly in various places in the dining room until enough time had passed to usher everyone out without it seeming chair-related. I took a handful of aspirin and started cleaning up the leftovers, picking at what was left on the trays and serving dishes we'd eventually have to drive around delivering to their rightful owners. The donuts tormented me, nestled so sweetly in their box, but, bitch, I just had a chair collapse underneath me, So please pass the fucking watermelon balls. We bought new chairs the next goddamn day. Metal ones. My friend Anna once got up in this kid's face during gym class because he kept asking how much I weighed. The truth was that I didn't actually know because my mom was too broke and too much of a wreck to take me to the doctor. But what I did know was that it was the very first time I had to change clothes in front of people, and as humiliating as it might have been to try to hide my bulging, discolored body from girls who were at the ideal height and weight for their ages, I also had to ride the shame wave of having a mother who couldn't pay for both the school-issued shorts and the t-shirt, so the dingy white shirt with a red lion on the front that didn't get washed enough was paired with women's shorts, capital W, to distinguish them from the slender misses and the dainty petites, found in the $2 bin at ESCA, the place where your well-off classmates' parents donated the family's old clothes. So yes, Rebecca, I actually am wearing your dad's old sweatshirt today. Anyway, these ESCA shorts were more of a tomato red, let's say a Pantone 032, than the official deep red, Pantone 1807, of the Nichols Middle School Lions, and they stood out in stark contrast to the ones my peers were dressed in, whose names were written in permanent marker on the white strip of material on the right thigh that my home shorts noticeably did not have. I don't know enough about sociopolitical stuff to write intelligently about classism in this country, but purchasing and maintaining a $50 short set required for 20 minutes of half-hearted daily physical activity is a big deal to people who can't keep a phone on, and it's thoroughly humiliating for the person singled out at the start of every period for not being dressed correctly for class. Would it have killed that leather-faced monster to cut me a break just once? I learned how to operate under both the physical and emotional weight of unrelenting shame very early. Fat babies are adorable, while fat children are a little less so. Fat teenagers are chided into either end of the eating disorder spectrum, and fat adults are either admonished for not figuring out how to get new bodies during adolescence, or straight up dismissed altogether. I wish that I was an emotionally healthy human without years of accumulated trauma, one who just decided to be a fat caricature of a person perched gleefully atop a mountain of donuts, shoving candy bar after candy bar between my teeth while cackling demonically over how much money my eventual care will cost taxpayers, or whatever it is comment section trolls always accuse fat people of doing. And I don't need sympathy or special consideration because, ultimately, who even cares? You hate me, and I hate me too. We're on the same team. I guess what I'm saying is that maybe we could all just mind our own fucking business for once. And that when you can actually see a person's scars, maybe be a pal and don't pick at them. Do you think that fat people don't know? Because we definitely do. We're repulsive to look at and undeserving of both love and easily accessible, relatively inexpensive, yet well-made clothing. We get it. We have seen the messages in movies and magazines, on the internet and TV, and we understand. If we wear something form-fitting, we're delusional pigs who have the audacity to think we look attractive. But if we wear shapeless sacks that hide all our offensive, stretched-out flesh, we're sloppy dirtbags who need to get our shit together. It's a lose-lose unless you lose weight, but good luck keeping it off without reconstructing your entire brain and DNA. I'm sure people get skinny and stay that way. And if they want to invite me over for little cups of green tea and a handful of unsalted pretzels to split between us so they can tell me how they did it, man, I'm down with that. Especially if they know the secret to making a radish feel as good on your tongue as a salty, sweet piece of smoked pork belly that's all caramelized on the outside, but soft and fatty on the... Wait, what was I even talking about? A couple of years ago, some woman thought I was someone else she'd been beefing with online and tweeted a slew of things that I assume were intended to be hurtful at me, including such darling missives as, "You're a shitty writer and you should die," and "You look like you're one hot dog away from a heart attack." I don't know how you say something like that to a person you've never met, a person who has never done anything wrong to you, with the entire internet watching, but yeah, okay, I probably am. My heart is enlarged and in the early to middle stages of failure because for a long time, I couldn't afford this medicine I was supposed to take. Now that I can, the damage is irreversible, so I'm just going to do what I can until it suddenly stops beating and hope that when it quits on me, I am wearing something flattering and not behind the wheel of a car. And when it does happen, despite all these years of trying, despite all these fits and starts, I will still be dead. And maybe you and that faceless Twitter person will think I deserve it. And that's okay. I am fat and I am mentally ill, and those two things have been intertwined since before I even knew what those words mean. If this is how I'm going to die, then why not just let me? Maybe there is a way to solve those problems, but maybe I'm tired of trying. Maybe I stopped going to swimming because I was afraid of what would happen if, after months of treading water, it still didn't work. Maybe I quit yoga because I was afraid of what would happen if I lost a ton of weight and that still didn't fix my insides. I can't afford therapy, but I can buy a sandwich. Nashville Hot Chicken. By this point in our nascent relationship, Mavis and I had figured out how to mash our moist and sweaty sex parts together with marginally enjoyable results, suffered through awkward introductory meals with each other's closest friends slash families, including a surprise birthday party I totally almost ruined by being a pouty asshole, and gone in on a family cell phone plan. It was time for us to plan our first joint vacation. Thoughtful romantic that I am, I texted, "Hey, instead of flying first class to Jamaica to drink rum out of coconuts and risk skin cancer roasting under the sun, how would you feel about instead spending 9 hours wedged into a rented car with my dead dad's ashes to go to Nashville and eat biscuits and gravy and listen to terrible country music for a week?" In hindsight, I realize that that is a heavy fucking thing to ask a normal person with actual human feelings to accompany you to do. In my mind, it was like Weekend at Bernie's, but in real life, she is a mom she talks to on the phone once or twice a week and isn't used to my whole LOL I killed my mom shtick. This could be an emotional minefield. I'm not sure that I can articulate this exactly the way I want to without alienating anybody cool, but my parents have been dead for so long that it almost isn't even sad to me anymore. I can't remember their voices or what they like to put on their pizza. I couldn't tell you what teams my dad rooted for or what shade of lipstick my mom liked to wear. They had no part in my adult life, so it's not like I miss our Sunday dinners or their career guidance. And if I'm being straight up, I know that if the trajectories of their lives had continued down the paths they were on, I'd be sharing a one-bedroom apartment with my mom and giving her a daily lottery ticket allowance while my dad spent every day passed out in a racetrack bathroom. My life would be the kind of sitcom that's more situation than comedy, full of scenes in which my adorably confused mother called me in my sad beige cubicle 5 times to remind hapless me to pick up her cigarettes at the gas station where my potential love interest works on the way home from the office, as my stereotypical angry employer stands huffing over me, the audience collectively worried that this is the episode that my likable, yet annoying and overbearing mother will get me fired. My dad would make a cameo during sweeps week, all dressed up in a Salvation Army suit, smelling like Old Spice, and make a lot of promises he had no intention of keeping, then disappear at the end of the episode, not to be seen again until the season finale. There would be lots of walking home late in the rain montages in which I'd adjust my unwieldy purse and clumsily drop the bag of Doritos I'm going to eat for my dinner on the floor. The gas station attendant, who was secretly handsome under his oil-stained cap and thick, out-of-style glasses, works up the nerve to do something about his long-standing crush. He won't, though, at least not this season. He'll just watch me with longing as I tuck the pack of Virginia Slims next to the sensible office heels in my work bag. "Ma'am," he'll call out as I reach the door, and everyone at home on the couch will totally lose their shit because maybe he really is going to put down his wrench and sweep me into his strong, alternator-fixing arms. I'll turn around hopefully, because I have a secret crush on him, too, and, duh, I've never been kissed, and an Aretha Franklin song is swelling to a crescendo in the background. And holy fuck, I might finally get to have sex, but that hope shatters into a million pieces as I realize he's just holding out a pack of matches to take home to my mom. Roll credits. Sad trombone. That is for real what my life would be. Shame spiraling into spinsterhood as my mom made an ever-evolving list of reasons I could never move out and abandon her. We would definitely have too many of whatever pet we could both agree on. And she would sit smoking in her armchair and nodding along with Oprah while calling me constantly throughout the day to either, one, remind me of things she needed me to bring home, or two, recount to me, in explicit detail, the happenings on her various beloved television programs. We'd be the type of people who had both of our names on household accounts. You know what I mean? Like when you get a new MasterCard and there's that, do you want to add an authorized user box? The one I currently check fuck no on while doing the untethered single person running man. I would answer a begrudging yes and get a second card with Gray Serby on it. We would undoubtedly be sharing a bed, one that I definitely made the quilt for, and I would never post anything on Facebook other than videos of frolicking baby goats and inspirational infographics while wishing real hard every night that someone at the church would force her nonverbal son, who is too sensitive to get a job, to take me on a date to Baker Square and ask to touch my privates after. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's okay they're dead. Our family tree is so goddamn sparse that if you shake it, you'd probably start a fire. My dad was born in Mississippi, but spent his formative years in Memphis, where he fathered my brothers before ditching them to move to Chicago and eventually meet my mother, who already had three young girl children of her own. I have neither seen nor spoken to either of my brothers since they attended my mom's funeral in June 1998. That's part of the reason I've never done anything with our dad, because it's just my luck that the minute I decided to dump that asshole in a barbecue grill or sprinkle him outside the shady SRO he lived in for a while, one of them would turn up and be upset that I hadn't included him in the decision. Our father was terrible. He tried three times and still couldn't get the kind and loving parenting thing down. But it still nagged at me that they might want to say goodbye or something. My sisters don't give a shit. He was the kind of jerk stepfather who yelled a lot about nothing and nailed the window shut after they'd snuck out of them at night to go meet their boyfriends. My brothers are not men who Facebook. They are not gentlemen who tweet. Once every couple of years, I'll do some lightweight Google sleuthing and call the first handful of phone numbers I run across, but they have all led to dead ends. The last time I was in Memphis, I was 15, and spent the entire time taking pictures of heartbroken women earnestly sobbing over Elvis's grave with a disposable drugstore camera, not risking getting my head blown off going door to door asking, "Are you my brother?" in unfamiliar neighborhoods. So I ended up with SB on a technicality. The thought of physically handling his ashes in order to transfer them from the box they came in to a nicer container horrified me. Plus, I ain't got no fireplace. Where the fuck was he supposed to go? Should I have, like, displayed him? Not doing that ever. But isn't it wildly disrespectful to just, throw him away? Is there no discreet disposal service I could use? Why did they make me his guardian? I hate being in charge of things. It would have been an easier decision if I had a house, because then I could just dump him in a hole and plant a rose bush in it or something. And when house guests admired my garden, I could explain to them how I'd ingeniously repurposed my father's cremains and look like a thoughtful and sentimental person. But I'm broke and can barely keep the tiny succulents in my studio alive, so instead of doing anything with him, I hid the giant can of rocks and dust that used to be Samuel Irby in that Gap bag on the top shelf of my hall closet and decided to ignore him. It would be a fitting metaphor for the bulk of my childhood. Plus, I didn't think my dad would give a shit, really. I was more haunted by the ghost of the old boyfriend I'd purchased those fucking Gap sweaters for. I am not sentimental. I don't save birthday cards or baby pictures or newspaper clippings. I have no real traditions, and I throw everything away the minute it stops being shiny and new. Still, one day I realized that dusty box full of my dad's ground-up bones and brains had been sitting between the cat carrier and a bag of mittens for 7 years, and I was determined not to move it to another apartment ever again. My dad died 18 years ago. It was time for my dude to get free and stop grossing me the fuck out every time I needed a goddamn jacket. I decided to take him to Nashville to dump the ashes of my dead father in one of Tennessee's 30-plus rivers or tributaries so he could float on and become one again with the earth or whatever, but also to kind of try to have a vacation. Like I said, he was technically from Memphis, but I've been there a lot. There are only so many times you can trudge through the excruciatingly depressing mausoleum that is Graceland without wanting to scoop your fucking eyes out with a grapefruit spoon, so I wasn't doing that again. I needed to get rid of him, and it needed to be in a place that felt like it had at least a little bit of sentimental value in case any of my future children, red cats, ever ask about their grandfather. It also needed to be someplace close enough that I could drive there without dislocating my fucking knee, yet far enough that my boss couldn't get cute and try to call me into work. My hipster friends with good taste like Nashville. There are a lot of kinfolk-looking blogs espousing Nashville's many hidden gems, and Nashville has a shitload of good restaurants. If my daddy had really wanted to split hairs about his final resting place, he should have left a goddamn will instead of overdrawn checking accounts and a bunch of gambling debts and worthless old scratch-off tickets. That motherfucker was getting scattered in Nashville. I am for sure about to be called a nigger with the hard R. That is what I was thinking while Mavis and I sat in my rented Toyota Camry outside a Huck's gas station in Madisonville, Kentucky. According to the faded signs in the window, you could get a pack of cigarettes here for less than $3. You can't even get a newspaper in Chicago for $3 motherfucking. Should I move? I mean, I don't smoke and the South is terrifying to me, but last week I spent $13 on some trash called young raw coconut juice, and that is really not the kind of life I want to be living anymore. Anyway, we'd been in the car for 7 hours, me behind the wheel as we darted between terrifying big rigs and 1976 Toyota pickup trucks driven by mulleted, shirtless teenagers. Mavis thought it would be romantic to take the small and beautiful back roads due south, rather than the ugly, congested highway with its bright lights, densely populated McDonald's, and the kinds of white people who care about driving fuel-efficient hybrid cars. So we had been singing along with a 200-song Spotify playlist I packed with bona fide jams, like Return of the Mac and the Human Nature remix of SWV's Right Here. If you weren't a teenager in the early 90s, then I am terribly sorry for you. To keep me awake on the road while driving through hundreds of miles of desolate farmland. A man wearing thick white athletic socks shoved into Adidas shower shoes shuffled past the car, studying my stylish urban mohawk with an intense curiosity. "My barber fades it by hand," I almost called out, my polite northern way of asking exactly what the fuck he was motherfucking staring at, but decided against it. "Mavis is a healthy person. Reason number 137 why I am convinced she will quickly grow tired of me and my bullshit right after votes in local elections and has never eaten a Hot Pocket purely for enjoyment of the taste. Healthy people keep themselves properly hydrated, and this was the third time we'd had to stop and find her a bathroom in the kinds of towns where Confederate money is still accepted as legal tender. I'm the opposite of whatever she is, the kind of person whose extra-large drive-through Diet Coke had lasted from Broadway in Thorndale to the middle of Kentucky, and I hadn't once had the urge to pee. Or shit, for that matter, since I had eaten only a handful of saltines and Imodium for breakfast. I don't need that kind of stress, man. I would rather fight Moby Dick on a raft with a hole in it than be stuck in a car in the middle of nowhere, groundhogging a giant poop, or squatting on the side of the interstate with nothing but Mavis's skinny legs for cover. Mavis emerged from the sliding glass doors, loaded down with water bottles and whatever healthy snacks are to be found in a country-ass gas station. A blazing neon sign in the window blinked an advertisement for hot fried chicken and gizzards, and maybe I'm disgusting, but there really was an internal struggle between the part of my brain that is averse to eating food left out in the open under a heat lamp and the part that knows that chicken was probably delicious. I spent the entire rest of the drive dreaming about those room-temperature gizzards as my stomach growled loudly in protest. I really dig a fancy fucking hotel, and we picked the fucking fanciest. Nothing like rolling up to the tastefully appointed valet and handing him the grocery bag you packed your one outfit in as you hold out your arm and painfully unfold your plastic travel slippers and stained yoga pants and cramping limbs from where they've been molded around a steering wheel for half a day. I'm not going to continue to put too fine a point on this, but getting with someone the total opposite of you is the goddamn move. This is how I pack for a 5-day trip. Many underpants, maybe an extra bra, multiple socks, maybe 2 t-shirts, a hoodie, and a bag of dehydrated sriracha bacon and a fountain drink for the car. This is how Mavis packs. Many separate top and bottom options, including, but not limited to, multiple shorts and shirts, dresses short and long, skirts, running slash exercise tanks and shorts, a special moisture-wicking tight bra, athletic socks, several sandals, a pair of gym shoes, at least one romper, an extra carburetor, a full silver service, a twin-size bed, several different types of Tylenol, and a cooler full of dry snacks and drinks and coffee. It never even occurred to me that I might do anything other than survive off of whatever I could find in a vending machine or from room service. She's a real-life adult. It's impressive. The morning after we arrived, I awoke in a bed larger than my entire apartment and suddenly remembered why I rarely ever take vacations. Trips cost a lot of money, and I don't ever really feel like doing anything I couldn't already be doing in my own bed. I never wake up excited at the promise of a new day. Instead, I grudgingly tear my eyelids apart while dreading whatever soul-crushing obligation is on the other side of my door. A job, a phone call, a lunch. I would rather be dead than do any of it. Mavis was already out in the world. The note she'd left next to the bed let me know that she had gone out for a run, and LOL, what do those words even mean? I toddled around the room in a sleep haze, wiping crust out of